Well, good evening and welcome to the latest of our director's dialogues. And for the benefit of those who haven't been before, just the rules of this game are that I begin by asking the questions, and that goes on for 20 minutes, half an hour or so, but then I throw it open to you, and if nobody has a question immediately, I choose people in the front row. So you get an opportunity to move if you want. Delighted to welcome David Tweedy here, who is chairman of the International Accounting Standards Board. And before that, he was chairman of the domestic UK Accounting Standards Board. And before that, was the national technical partner for KPMG. And before that, was Thomson McClintock. Is that right? Yeah, one of those pairs of names that have now disappeared into the maw of one of the big four, and was educated, if that's the right word, in Edinburgh, and did a PhD in accounting as well. Now, I carry some modest responsibility for him being in his present position, because when I was chairman of the Financial Services Authority, the SEC, then chaired by Arthur Levitt, and the FSA decided that we really needed to give the impetus, give some more impetus to the move towards international accounting standards, and a sort of complicated political, transatlantic political deal was done whereby there should be a group, a board of trustees chaired by Paul Volcker, an alumnus of this school, who has actually only just a couple of weeks ago, really, wasn't it, or months ago, stepped down in favour of Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa, and that the Americans would agree that if we had Paul Volcker as chair of the trustees, that we could have David Tweedy as chair of the board to do the work of developing the standards. And with some strains and hiccups since then, that deal has actually stuck for the last 6 or 7 years. But I guess more importantly than being just a great accounting standard setter, David also has a huge reputation as an after-dinner speaker. It's hard to imagine that you could have a reputation as an after-dinner speaker on accounting standards, but it has been said of him that he is one of the most amusing Scottish accounting standard setters of his generation. And we hope that that will come across this evening as well. But let me kick off, David, by just asking you, I suppose, what is really the big question that anyone would want to put to you, which is, do you think that Scotland's win over France means you really have a team now, or is this just a flash in the pan?
No, I think we'll take England apart in 3 weeks' time.
Thank you very much. Well, that's enough on rugby. But the big question really is, you are engaged in this massive exercise of trying to develop international accounting standards. But is this really likely to be crowned with success? Will the Americans ever agree that there are international accounting standards which can be used for US listings and which are preferable to the famous US GAAP? I mean, or are you pursuing a chimera here?
Well, I think the if you'd asked me that question about 4 years ago, I'd have probably said no, they wouldn't accept international standards. Enron, WorldCom and all the others made a huge difference to them. And it wasn't as though it was actually accounting problems. It was more corporate governance that was the issue. Most of the issues there were fraud and other malfeasance that had been going on. Basically, I think what happened, they suddenly started to look outside the United States to see... there were things they could learn from outside. And what's happened since, we in a way took advantage of the Enron situation, and we made a deal with the American standard setter that it didn't seem to make any sense to have two different ways of accounting for the same thing. So why didn't we just pick the best one? And what we did is we started looking through the differences between the two sets of standards, and they're shown up by the fact that if you list in the US and you are not an American company, you have to reconcile to US standards. So in a way all the differences start to be thrown up by these reconciliation statements. And we sort of gradually worked our way through these things, and some of them were quite spectacular. They changed some, we changed some. For example, the impairment of goodwill and brands they took from, in fact, the UK, and that absolutely amazed me, because I remember when we first brought it into the UK and as an international standard, the chief accountant in the SEC at the time was apoplectic. He said, "This is outrageous. We've solved the problem of accounting for goodwill and brands in the US some 30 years ago, and that is to write them off over 40 years. And as I pointed out to him, in the UK we have brands such as Gordon's Gin and Johnny Walker that are actually older than the United States. And in my humble opinion, I've done more for the sum of human happiness than the United States. And personally, I'd write off America for whatever write off Johnny Walker Black Label." But they changed. They started taking these things. And gradually, the mood started to alter. Now, it was taking too long. We reckon if we kept going at this speed, it would be something like 2015 before we got rid of the reconciliation. So we had meetings with the SEC over the last year or so and to say, well, what can we do to accelerate it? Why don't we just hit the big ones? Never mind all the little bits and pieces. Just go for the big changes. And that's what we've decided to do. Now, hopefully we'll announce something next week about doing this. But broadly speaking, we've each got about five or six standards where we can think, well, clearly the other side's got a better answer. Why don't we just pick that answer and stick it in? For example, capitalising interest costs. We're going to do that. Now, never mind the way we do it. We don't have to do it the American way, we're just going to do it, and that solves that problem. They're going to take the fair value option that's under our financial instrument standard. But then comes the question, what do we do with all these standards that they're pretty old, they're pretty ancient, they're not very good. We could reconcile them, and then we'd still end up with some pretty old, pretty ancient standard that wasn't very good. And so why don't we just write another one? So what we've done is we've listed about 11 subjects where we're looking at accounting, we think it's pretty poor, both with us and with the Americans, and we'll write joint standards. Now, that'll take us till 2010-11. People can't wait that long for the reconciliation. But what the SEC, it's not been announced yet, but what the SEC is thinking about is, well, if you can show you're on a path to complete convergence, we'll accept it when it's quite clear the path's underway. So that means probably producing the initial discussion statement on each of these 11 subjects. Do that, reconciliation goes, even though the standards are different. There'll be mutual recognition, with the idea as long as that process continues, they will gradually be the same. Now, I suspect the Americans will never give up using their standards, but if the answers are pretty close, who cares? And that's where I think we're going, Howard.
And is that work being done by the IASB staff or FASB staff or joint teams, or how is that working?
It is joint teams, and the idea that the same papers go to both boards at the same time, and then all flows back in again. And we have a disputes committee that basically, if we just disagree, they have to sit down and try and hammer out an answer that both boards could accept. And there's obviously compromises. We don't always get our own way, but neither do they either.
So, but is there not some degree of asymmetry here? Because the International Accounting Standards Board is supposed to be what it is. It's supposed to be a global accounting standards board. But essentially, the way you describe it, you're engaging in bilateral negotiations with the US. So it's the US sort of versus the rest of the world. And you're not, in fact, doing the same kind of negotiation with the UK Accounting Standards Board or the French Accounting Standards Board.
No, well, when we started, we were we had to have eight liaison standards setters that we had board members actually sitting in their meetings. Now, if you look at what happened to the eight, there was the three Europeans, Germany, France, UK. They have to take our standards. The European Commission and the European Union decided from last year, consolidated accounts had to use our standards. So their powers have been taken away to a great extent. They've still got powers for other companies other than listed. Australia and New Zealand came in right away. Once Europe had made that decision, they said, well, we too will go. Canada just last year announced they were giving up Canadian standards and moving to international, which surprised us because we thought they'd go US GAAP. Japan has a convergence program with us to bring their standards in line. So in a way, they're all coming in line with us, and the only two gorillas out there now are the US and ourselves. And the idea is that we actually just bring these two sets together because half the world, not half the world, but quite a lot of the world uses US standards. 100 countries use ours, and gradually they're coming together. We think by 5 years' time, US standards now will be so alike
plus the fact that China has announced it's coming in, India's thinking about it, Israel's coming, Chile's coming, there's a momentum starting to build up. And I think it's partly the fact that the reconciliation is going as well. People are becoming aware we're trying to get rid of this thing as fast as we can.
So in so within 5-8 years' time or whatever, a UK company listing in the US will still have to reconcile, do you think, but the reconciliation won't mean anything, or will they not have to reconcile?
The idea is even within 2 years, we hope within 2 years we'll have done enough to show this process is underway, and then there'll just be mutual recognition, no reconciliation, just acceptance.
Now, turning then to, that's the kind of US dimension, I'm sure people will have more to ask, but just turning back to the European dimension, of course it hasn't been entirely plain sailing for you there either. And I can remember when I was at the FSA, letters, even personal letters from Jacques Chirac to the European Commission, complaining about the terrible things you were doing to the French insurance industry and the French banking industry, etc. Typically centred on IAS 39, the accounting for financial instruments instrument. Where has that got to? Have you resolved that problem? Are you and Jacques on, you know, speaking terms now?
Not really. I think we operate now in an atmosphere of mutual trust and understanding. I don't trust them and they don't understand me, I think. basically. What has happened since is the fact that, I don't know if you know IAS 39, but if you understand it, you haven't read it properly. This is a very, very complicated standard. It's the American standard, bluntly. And it's got all sorts of ways you deal with financial instruments. There's four different ways you deal with them. Why four, you may ask, good question. Then they've got exceptions and exceptions to exceptions, so the whole thing is a mess. It's a cottage industry. We have a few experts that think they understand it, and they dictate what happens within the big accounting firms and so on. We've really got to change it completely. But in the meantime, we're left with this situation where we have arguments between particularly France and ourselves, and we could have solved it. I remember when we were having this discussion, the European Commission said, look, you know, you've got to get the French to agree, or we can't endorse this standard. So we said, have you told the French they've got to agree? And he said, yes. And I said, well, in which case, we're not going to get an agreement. They don't want the standard. So what's in it for them? And when we moved on, it was quite clear that what would it give them, what we could do to get France on board was very simple. It was to allow the losses and gains, for that matter, on derivatives not to go through P&L account, not to go through equity, but to sit on the balance sheet as assets and liabilities. And as we said, well, if we went to a French bank and we asked for a loan and they asked for collateral, would they accept the loss on this derivative for this collateral, since they seem to think it's an asset? And the answer was, don't be stupid. And we said, well, who started it? We just can't show losses as assets. It's just not acceptable. So if that's what it takes, we can't do it. And that was when the carve-out started. So we wouldn't accept that.
So what is the position now? Is there a carve-out?
Yep, there's a carve-out that makes it easier for these banks not to have to show these hedging transactions and so on. And we think probably 30 major European banks will use this carve-out. One of the problems is it's not obvious that they've used it, which is a bit of a problem. So we're watching. In the next 6 months, it'll come clear how many have done it. But we've been working with them on trying to get rid of it, but ultimately it's a case of they've invented a new hedging method, which frankly we don't understand, and we've put various questions like, what risk are you hedging? How do you know it's effective for hedge? We haven't had answers yet, and we've really said, well, until we get the answers, we're going to do something else. That's Europe's problem. Nobody else has this problem except Europe, so let's move on.
So the US banks are not using that carve-out at all, and nobody else outside Europe. So what is the essence of this? I mean, when I was regulating, it seemed to me that at the heart of it was a different concept of banking, if you like, in that you had one set of people, obviously, particularly exemplified by the US investment banks, for whom anything was potentially tradable. So they loved fair value because any loan you put on, you might package up and secure it. You might not, but in principle, it was something, you know, your balance sheet was tradable. The European banks' original business model is that they are relationship banks, house banks of their companies, and they see it a nonsensical notion that you lend a company 100 million euros and then immediately provide for a loss on it because that's the fair value of it. They see that's nonsensical because they wouldn't have lent it if they didn't think they were going to get it back, and they have this permanent relationship. So in a way, it seemed to be that what you were doing was striking at the heart of their concept of banking. Now, isn't that just an irreconcilable conflict?
Well, it is up to a point. I think one of the issues is that our model of fair value isn't complete, because one of the areas where we have an interesting argument, which applies to insurance as well, is the question of if someone puts £100 in a bank deposit, what is that worth? Now, the rules in the US and the rest of the world is, well, if I can turn up and ask for £100 back, the liability is 100. But in fact, if a bank buys that, it'll probably buy it for 97. And the reason is that what they're buying is not the liabilities per se, but they're also buying the continuing relationship with the customer and the potential profits. So we have a difference there. Now, that is actually part of the European model, except they don't mark them down to market. But that is partly part of the issue. And that might be the way we can solve this, but we've got to move into a totally different area where the regulators are very nervous of somebody instantly receiving 100 and then saying, well, actually it's only worth 97, so we've got a profit of 3. Now, the way around that might be, in fact, that the liability isn't genuinely 100, but attached to it is a consumer intangible, which is, if you like, future trading with the customer, which is 3 on the other side. So there's huge issues to discuss rather than a rather unusual hedging method which the French want to discuss at the moment. I'd rather move the debate onto something slightly different, and let's look at the whole model. We've got the same thing in insurance. What's the value of an insurance policy? Is it the surrender value, or is it the fact that only, I don't know how many, you'd know better than I, Howard, how many will actually surrender? And we should look at more a behavioural aspect rather than simply just take some raw number that's come out of the surrender values.
But on the ISO 9 itself, you began your first answer by saying that it is a very, very complicated and in many ways flawed instrument. So do you have a team of gnomes currently working away at devising a better mousetrap?
Yeah, what we've done now is we've said, well, let's just look at this thing. There's a big argument about having principle-based standards. Well, principle-based standards can be very short, they can be very tough, because if you want principle-based, you don't have lots of application guidance, you don't have lots of exceptions, you don't have scope exceptions, you have a very tight standard. Now, what would be a financial instrument standard that was principle-based? Well, firstly, I suppose you would say that all financial instruments should be marked to market and taken to income. That's paragraph one. Paragraph two could actually be read paragraph one again. You know, it could be as blunt as that. Now, that almost certainly would not be acceptable, mainly because of reliability notions. How do you show the volatility in the accounts? So we really need to come back. Why did we get into this state with IAS 39? Now, this was one we inherited. Everyone thinks we wrote it, but we didn't. And basically, they started off by saying, well, if you're trading financial instruments, everyone accepts you mark them to market, take it to income. There's absolutely no dispute about that. Then came people saying, well, we don't actually trade them. We hold them to maturity. Okay, so you're not interested in gains and losses in the meantime. We just take the gain and loss at the end, show it at cost, and then take the gain and loss at the end. And then, because standard setters are cynics, they say, well, what happens if somebody is holding this thing to maturity, but profits are down, but meanwhile there's a nice big fat gain in one of these things being held to maturity, and he sells it? They're going to just play games with profit all the time. So they said, we're going to put a restriction. If you do that, then you mark everything to market and take it through income. And then howls of protest. You know, that's far too strict, because we think we're going to hold it at maturity, but we can't guarantee it. So we may have to, for various reasons, sell it. So they brought another category in, which said, well, these are available for sale. Might be held to maturity, might not. Mark them to market, but take the gains and losses to equity and drop them into income when you sell it. So you've got these three categories all set out. Now, do we need three? We have two methods of hedging. Do we need two? You can hedge portions of an item. Do we need to hedge portions? Why, if you've got derivatives, do you not just mark it to market and show the other side the way it turns out, instead of a portion of the other side. And it is just a very complicated standard. Now, I'm sure we can actually do an awful lot just to make it a lot simpler. At the moment, I would think probably less than 1% of the profession really understands it. And that's, you can't write accounting standards like that. It's got to be something that 80% thinks. It's not rocket science, but it looks it at the moment.
We turn to, I'll throw it open in a couple of minutes, but we turn to a couple of other points I'd be interested in your view on. You referred to China thinking about international accounting standards. One of the big developments of the last few years, of course, has been the entry of China into the world's financial economy, if you like, and now the flotation of their banks. What's your perception of the quality of accounting in China and the quality of the accounting of the large Chinese companies who come to market?
Well, I think it's improving quite rapidly. It's one of the sort of scary things when you go to China. I know you've been there quite often now, but the first time I went was about 10 years ago, and crossing the streets was lethal because there was thousands of bicycles coming at you. Now you hardly see one, it's cars. I mean, the change is phenomenal. And the same in accounting. I went to the World Congress of Accounting, which was held in Hong Kong, and they had the Chinese Prime Minister opening it. It's the only time I've ever been confused by a Chinese Prime Minister, because I was speaking the opening program along with him and Paul Volcker. And after we'd met the Prime Minister, we were asked to take our seats first. And so I came round the corner along this red carpet. And because of my massive height, they obviously thought I was the Chinese Prime Minister. So the band struck up the Chinese national anthem, and everyone had to stand. And I felt very embarrassed standing there, wondering whether I waved to them, until the MC sort of said, "Oh, sit down and start again." But he said in his speech, "We must have no false accounting." And you think, well, that's the sort of thing politicians say. And when I actually got to China and saw what he'd done, he'd realised that if China was going to really have financial markets, they had no infrastructure whatsoever, no professions, he's going to have to build one. And he'd been in Chicago and seen the Arthur Anson Training School there. This was before poor old Arthur Anson blew up. But he then built three, one in the south of China, one in Beijing, and one in Shanghai. And these are modern campuses, and I've been to two of them. One hadn't existed 3 years before I got there. It was just a greenfield site, and now these beautiful universities. And they're pushing them through. And that's going to take time, because when you go and give a talk in China, you don't see any grey hair. I mean, they're all people about under 30. That's the profession. And of course, they've no experience. The big firms are putting people in there, but they've a way to go. And that's what worries them. It's quite interesting looking at the Ministry of Finance. Obviously, a decision's been made up above that China's got to have international standards. So China gets international standards, not subject to debate. That's it. Happens. So they're busily rewriting all their standards. But it's quite interesting watching them thinking, well, wait a minute. People aren't too skilled in this area. We ought to take a very tough line to make sure there's no doubts, such as impairment. Once you impair it, it stays impaired. You don't write it back again, because they don't trust people. They think they'll manipulate profits. So they try to build in all sort of prudential aspects in their accounting. But broadly speaking, they're moving fast. But they're young and inexperienced, and there may be one or two hiccups before they get there.
Now, you referred, last question for me, you referred to the Arthur Anderson Training School, and of course the big consequence for the accounting profession of Enron and the other corporate governance things was the end of Arthur Anderson, and so now we end up with four accounting firms for most multinational businesses. Do you think that is a sustainable position and an adequately competitive market?
No, I think it was, I was listening to Michel Prada, who said he was worried when there was only 12 of them, never mind four. And I think Anderson going has been very sad, and it didn't deserve to go, and there were certain people who had done things that weren't very smart, and they should have gone, but to cripple the firm was outrageous, I think. I think there's real concern another one could go, and you suspect KPMG may have had problems with the tax issues recently, had it not been for the example of Anderson's, because three is even worse, obviously, than four. So, no, I think there's a lot of talk about
can we build some other ones? But that's not going to be very easy.
So what do we do about it, then?
Well, that's one of the big issues that's up there. The interesting thing about it is that those of us who've been in these multinational firms are not quite as united as people think, and bits fly off in all different directions. It may be possible to build another one or two, but it won't be very easy. It's going to be very difficult, and maybe we just have to accept there's going to be different firms like Binders and Grant Thornton. Can we build them up? I'm not sure.
I mean, they have shown not obvious enthusiasm for wanting to be a huge international firm, and a couple of them have said to me that the last thing they want to do is to get into that marketplace.
Well, very much so. And you notice it coming through the fact there's this nervousness in the profession. People talk about using judgment and having principles, and they love principles, but could you please answer these 400 questions we've got? And I suspect the compliance officers said the same thing at the FSE. And that's one of the big issues we have. Can we write short, sharp standards, or are people going to constantly ask for the answers to questions? I won't say which firm it was, but one of the big four had me along for dinner few months back and said that they felt they ought to warn me that they were about to launch an attack on the IASB that said our standards were too complicated, too involved. And I said, fine, you're entitled, you go ahead, and the day you publish it, I'll publish your last five submissions on our standards. They stand about this thick, and they're all full of, why haven't you dealt with this? What's the answer to that? The standard's defective because this bit's missing, and we want the answers, and so on. And the firms want certainty. So they can say to the client, says here. So judgment doesn't come into it. That is going to be a huge issue ahead of us. And part of it is going to be the problem of, it's not just litigation, it's actually regulation. They're very worried about the SEC making people restate the accounts. And we've had discussions with the SEC saying, well, if you really believe in principle-based accounting, that means you have to accept there'll be slightly different answers, because people will have judgments, and I might get 97 and somebody else might get 95. And I might use method A to meet the principle, and he uses method B, we still meet it. But if the SEC says, well, it's got to be method B, that's a rule. And how far can they come off that? It's the compliance division, not the accounting division, that the issue's with. So that's going to be one of the big areas we're discussing with them right now.
Hmm. Let me throw it open to the audience. Who'd like to kick off? Yeah, could we wait for your mic and give us your name if you can? That'd be good.
Yes, my name is Daniel. I'm visiting right now from Amsterdam. I have two questions, really. The first one is maybe you could elaborate a little bit on the implications that you feel the IAS 39 carve-out has for global and European financial markets in terms of stability and the like, in terms of supervision of financial institutions, for example. And the second one is whether you feel that it is indeed possible to have a single set of accounts fulfill both the function of telling the investor at every single moment what the value of the firm is in terms of if we were to liquidate it right now, and at the same time giving a true and fair idea or view, whatever, of how well management is actually doing with the equity and the other funds that stakeholders have put in. Is there not an inherent tension between the two, where one of the two will always lose out if we try to squeeze them into one set of accounts? Thank you very much.
Well, if I take the second one first, and you probably have to remind me of your first question. Basically, what we're trying to do is, how do we present information? Because one of the big issues we've got is the obsession with the bottom line. And as a Scot, I've always likened the bottom line to a haggis. You know, if you knew what was in it, you wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. Basically, what we have to do is start splitting it up and showing, well, what exactly has happened to this particular company. So, all right, you might have your profits from selling widgets, here's your treasury function, here's your long-term investments. Now, how do we break that down? That's one of the big issues we've got on right now. So, okay, you do get volatility, but if we can actually segment it, look at pensions, for example. In the UK, we show the full deficits or surpluses, mainly deficits, and they move about as the markets move and as interest rates move. But if you're saying, here's my operating profit from selling widgets, and by the way, here's what's happened to my pension fund, it's actually, how do we categorise? And that's one of the big discussions that's on just now globally. How do we do it to get the perspective? The 39 question and stability is partly related to that. Again, it is, how do we show what matters and what is, if you like, trading losses, because that's what you're trading. Now, if I'm an insurance company, I've got a 30-year portfolio,
and I'm sure that that's moving in a certain direction. I've 25 years or more to get that back again. It's not so urgent. And often people don't understand that. It's like the pension deficit. It doesn't have to be paid tomorrow like a creditor. It's going to be paid over the next 20, 30 years. But it's there, and the question then is, how can we get people a bit more sophisticated instead of looking at a simple number and then saying, well, the effect is disastrous? No, it's not disastrous. Look at the cash flow effects. We've got to take the thing as a whole, and that's part of the issue. People have just come to look at 39, and they haven't realised the extent of the values. The over-the-counter derivatives market last year, it was in the region of $10.7 trillion. Now, that's the gains and losses, actually, on these derivatives. Nothing on European balance sheets until this year. So it's come as a shock. But that's something we have to work on. And partly it's how we categorise and how we show the information properly. And then it's education.
Guy in the red jacket first.
What do you think will be the benefits from developing countries in taking the international accountants?
Well, the benefits, in a way, were really shown by the fact that we were started because of the Asian financial crisis. I mean, that was the real issue that pushed the change into the ISB. Previously, the arguments for international accounting was mainly the multinationals. You know, we've got subsidiaries in 60 countries, we have to have teams of accountants translating the accounts of 60 different ways of accounting back to UK standards or US GAAP or what have you. Complete waste of resource. But when you had the Asian crisis, what happened there was you had companies that looked fine under the accounting standards of that country suddenly going bust. And a lot of the finance was short term, was pulled out, interest rates shot up, investment stopped, growth stopped, unemployment rose, and there was suddenly this dearth of investment money. And that's one of the reasons many of them switched to international standards, simply because they didn't have to redo their own ones again. People trusted international more than they would theirs. And what has happened is China's a classic example, but other countries like New Zealand. New Zealand isn't developing in that sense, but nonetheless, it made the decision to get rid of New Zealand standards and take international. Now, why did it do that? When you spoke to the New Zealand government, and we spoke about one particular standard they've got, which is on consolidations, which is probably the best in the world, and we said, well, we can understand you going to international standards, but why don't you keep that one? Because we'll be changing to something very like it in a couple of years. And the answer was no, that would mean that we'd have to say New Zealand standards are almost the same as international, and nobody would think they're better, they think they're worse. And once you get a question mark, investors get nervous. Now, there is some research that shows that investors are much happier investing in the accounting that they understand, which is usually their home countries. So the more people that understand international accounting, the more chances they're willing to invest. Now, that's why China's changing its standards, because it wants inward investment. And the fact is, do you understand Chinese accounting? You'd have to go and spend a lot of time looking at it. Then there's the question, have I got all the nuances right? Is there something I don't quite understand? I better put a risk premium on the loans I'm making here. So that cuts down more investment. So this is the sort of cost, if you like, of not doing it. That's the advantage for developing countries, and that's why so many of them are taking it. We remove a risk factor. Now, okay, there's auditing and corporate governance and enforcement to be looked at as well, but the actual accounting, people are now familiar with it, and that's going to make a big difference, and that's why they're taking it. It's for inward investment. That's why Europe did it, because there are 25 countries.
Mm. Was it one at the near the back there? Thanks.
Hi, my name is John Clark. I used to be in the banking group of one of the big four, but I haven't been in practice for a couple of years. The question I had was that when I first, I think the fair value was sort of coming to the fore when I was in training, and when I first came across it as a concept, I thought, well, that must be right, intuitively that must be right, that's what you're trying to show, what is the fair value of the net assets of the company. But what I've never understood and what I wanted to ask for your opinion on is, what do you think the relationship should be between that fair value of net assets as per the accounts and the market capitalization of a company, which changes day by day? but it surely is a way of looking at the fair value of the company and all its assets, tangible and otherwise. I mean, it's hard to argue with the concept of fair valuing a derivatives trading book or something. But how widely does one try and should one draw that net about what you're trying to fair value? So, for example, your suggestion from earlier about fair valuing the customer relationship or maybe human capital or something like that. I wonder if I could just ask your thoughts on that. How widely should you be trying to draw that net? If you had a single principle that encapsulated that, what would it be?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question, because we're going to have that debate this year. One of the things that we're going to put down is the fact that people assume that everything we do is heading towards fair value, and that's just not practical, you know, quite frankly, because you've got reliability and volatility issues and presentational issues, as we mentioned. We haven't solved those yet. Now, when do people really feel that value is more important than cost? If it comes to plant and machinery, I don't think many people are jumping up and down and saying, we've got to value all these machines or something like that. So when do we use it? Now, with derivatives, I mean, a lot of the arguments we had from the European continent was, in fact, we should show them at cost. Well, there's hardly any cost. It's a contract. It's the gain and losses, the real feature about it. So I think that argument's gone. I mean, most people agree derivatives have got to be shown at value. But what else? And that's the issue we want to debate later on this year, and we intend to have round tables about it. That is where we invite people to come and give us their views. Now, before we write these standards, where do you think we should go? Which items should be at value, and when? Now, we're putting out an exposure draft probably later this year, which is based on an American standard, soon to be, which is how to value. Now, that's great for America, but what do you do in thin markets? And are these models reliable? Okay, we can say you've used a model and you tell us how much is model and how much is actually market-based. That will help give you sort of at least a warning. But do we even go as far as that or say in these circumstances, no, it's got to be cost, because that's all we can do, it's too unreliable. And that's the debate we want to have. So the issue, yes, the market capitalization of a company, which is often based, of course, on projected future profits and things like that, as well as breakup values, that isn't going to come into account yet.
David, in one of your answers just now, you did refer to research briefly. What you haven't said, and I'd be interested in your view on, is how far in these complex issues that you are dealing with, how far are you affected by, influenced by, assisted by research emerging from academic accounting departments? If the answer is not at all, I've got a few P45s to hand out to members of the faculty, but I mean, how much interaction is there between the International Accounting Standards Board and the academic community?
Well, we have two professors on our board, Mary Barth from Stanford and Jeff Whittingham from Cambridge. Now, we have actually been quite disappointed as we come up to issues and we look around the literature, there isn't very much. And some of it's on pretty basic issues. You know, what is equity? What's a liability? And there's almost nothing. And even a sort of very simple thing that, you know, our definition of a liability is an obligation that leads to resources leaving the organisation from which you cannot escape. So that if, as we discovered with a lot of the cooperative movements in Europe, you pay in 100, you're entitled to get 100 back anytime you want, that's a liability, an obligation which they can't escape. I can just walk and ask for it. That means none of these people have any equity whatsoever. They're very upset about that. They've just none. Then you go. We discovered, having said that, we then discover a New Zealand cooperative, which is a farming cooperative. It's the biggest company in New Zealand, as it happens. And yes, you can get your money back, but they value the company for you. And then you get your share of the company back. Well, technically it fits in our definition of a liability, but that sounds more like equity to me, because there is no market, there is no share. But nonetheless, it bounces up and down with the value of the company. So our definition isn't right. And we went looking. There's nothing. So even something simple like what's a liability and what's equity, nothing there. And what about special purpose entities? When should we consolidate? What's control? No. We're going to have to start from scratch. So that's in a way where I think a lot of the American research in the last few years has been sort of crunching numbers, you know, stock exchange movements and turning the handles doesn't help as much as regulators. Yeah, that's great. You can show the correlations and what have you. Good for quick publications, but actually hopeless for us. And we want some just issues like how should we account for leases? You know, one of my big ambitions is actually flying an aircraft that's on the airline's balance sheet before I die, because none of them are. You know, they're all leased, and the leasing standards are harmonised worldwide. They're absolutely useless. And the reason is we have two types of leases: operating, where you just charge what you pay each year, and finance. And the finance lease is where you'll have all the risks and rewards of the asset over its lifetime. And people wanted, what do you mean by that? So 20 years ago, a bright line was brought in saying, well, it's the present, if you, the amounts you pay, the present value of these are 90% the value of the asset, it's on balance sheet. Well, they all come in at 88%. And if we dropped it to 80, they come in at 79. They're designed that way. And when you go back and you say to the airline, well, why aren't you on balance sheet? You say, well, because we lease it for 7 years with a penalty clause if I don't do another seven. And I'm only committed for 7 years plus a penalty clause. And then go back to our definition of a liability, an obligation from which you can't escape. Well, British Airways, can you escape this? No. Can we measure it reliably? Set out in the legal contract. That's a liability. And on the other side, the right to a 747 for 7 years. Well, we've told the leasing industry this. I think this is the end of Western civilization as we know it. But that's where it leads you. And that's the sort of thing we need. What do we do? What do we do about renewal options? Do we take behavioural aspects into account? Or do we just do it when it's economically an economic compulsion to do so? You know, if you, companies might say, well, let's get around this by leasing our aircraft for a day. Well, there's always a danger that American Airways scoops them up and suddenly BA can't fly anymore. And, you know, what exactly is the issues there? How do we measure this liability? Do we take account renewals? Do we not? How do we do it? There's no research. Nothing.
Well, while the faculty are thinking about how to answer this attack on the fact that they're not doing anything useful, I had a question there, and then a question. Yep, this one in the front row, and then Richard.
Thank you, Sir David. Just going back to pensions again, could you just elaborate a little bit on sort of your latest thinking about how to value pension liabilities and pension deficit? And in particular, I would like to know whether you feel there's the actuaries and the accountants view starting to converge. Perhaps slightly connected, not totally connected. We have seen these excessively low levels of yields, particularly real yields in the market. Is this the fault of accounting standards or regulation? You mentioned that earlier. Was it just, in your view, rational exuberance by whoever?
There's several questions in there, but very good ones. I think pensions is probably one of our biggest issues, and pension accounting is particularly bad. Only the UK at present actually shows the deficits. Okay, we can argue about how it should be measured, but nonetheless, only the UK does that. If you look at the American standard, and the international for that matter, we brought in an option to do the UK one, which was taken up by most UK companies. What would happen if you had a pension fund with assets of 40 million and liabilities of 40 million? If the asset values fell 10 million, in the UK you'd show that, deficit 10 million. In America you would say, well, some of that 10 million is market noise, and we'll measure that at 10%, whatever's the higher, assets or liabilities. Well, the liabilities are higher at 40 million. So we take 10% of that and knock it off the deficit. So the deficit falls from 10 to 6. And then we say, yes, but it's a long-term thing. So we'll spread that over the working lives of the employees, let's say 10 years. So instead of a deficit of 10 million, you'll show a deficit of 600,000. Now, I defy you to explain that to your granny. I mean, you may as well take that 10 million and divide it by the cube root of the number of miles to the moon and multiply by your shoe size. It doesn't mean a thing. And that's where we're in trouble. Now, the problem that it leads to is people don't understand the problem they've got. And it was quite interesting, when we introduced FRS 17 in the UK, the 100 group, the top 100 companies, was split about 50-50, for and against. Two or three years on, it was quite different, because the comments were coming from them then, We are now discussing pensions in the boardroom. They hadn't before because the issue was just obliterated. You couldn't see the problem. And there it was, in their face, and people were asking questions. So they had to handle it. And they've done it quite well in many cases, because they're saying things like, okay, we've got a deficit of 50 million, we're going to put an extra 5 million a year in. We estimate the assets will generate 4% or whatever it is per annum. Change the scheme slightly. We reckon we'll be back in equilibrium by about 2010. The effect on profits compared to this year, 1.5%. Issue over. You know, people stop talking about it. Now, the problem in America, they've got a double problem because they've guaranteed most of the big companies healthcare from retirement to death. Now, one of the problems with healthcare is, you know, as people get older, bits fall off, and medical costs have a higher rate of inflation than normal inflation. So suddenly, when the US brought in a standard saying, these guys don't work for you anymore, you have given them a commitment. That is an obligation. That is a liability. And General Motors' liability was $32 billion. And that was 78% of its capitalization, just on healthcare costs. Now, if you look at the United States, top 500 companies, they have got unfunded healthcare and pensions of $500 billion. Most of that isn't on balance sheet, or is smoothed away in the way I described the earlier thing. There's also another problem, because when we charge pensions, and this applies to FRS 17 too, we could only change so much when we did it, but when you charge what my pension cost is, offsetting that, they then say, but okay, my charge is $1 million a year, but I estimate the long-term return on my assets is going to be $750,000. So I only put through a charge of $250,000. There's been some pretty heroic assumptions about the future returns going through. And in the United States in the last 5 years, and again in the top 500 companies, the amounts that have gone through to offset the cost have been $498 billion, US dollars. The actual returns have been $197 billion. So in that period, $301 billion have gone through the US income statements of the top 500 companies that are hope of what might happen in the future. Might happen, might not, but why don't we just show what happens and stop that happening? And that's going to be one of the big issues. Now, the measurement of the liability is another one. It's based on final salary. Why isn't it based on present salary? That's one issue. Secondly, what's the interest rate we should discount? You mentioned the question of the yields. When we started, we said to the actuaries, what interest rate should we use? And they said, you should use the yield on the assets in the fund. And we said, well, that just cannot be right, because if I have junk bonds, my liability doesn't disappear. So then it was the overall yield in equities. And that had some intuitive appeal, because you think, well, companies do well, share prices will go up, salaries will probably go up, so there seems to be some sort of connection between the two. And we pushed that internationally for about a year until the actuaries came along with the evidence which showed a correlation of zero. And that's why we went for the corporate AA bond, because everybody else did it and we'd run out of time. But we don't think that's necessarily the answer. So we've gone back to the actuaries saying, well, you're the experts, you tell us what the discount rate is. And I think people haven't realised the problems with pensions. What caught them out wasn't just the bear markets or tax changes. It was the fact that as interest rates fell, they didn't realise the effect. And it's very simple. You know, if annuity rates are 10% and you want to give someone a pension of 10,000, you have to put 100,000 in. If annuity rates are 5%, you've got to put 200,000. So they were hit with, you know, falling markets for the assets and rising liabilities. And I don't think they spotted the first bit. They didn't spot the second bit. And of course, now we've got this fact that people have developed this dreadful habit of living longer, and it's just got to stop.
Yeah. Richard McVeigh, can you?
Thank you. I won't start an argument now, David, about research. As you know, I'm a I've been a member of the ASB's academic panel for a long time. I'll just make an observation on that, and then I'll ask a question. But, you know, a question like, why can't you tell us what's the difference between equities and liabilities? Well, you know, there's a lot of philosophical research which will say that is not a very good question to ask in the first place. You can't pin things down absolutely like that. You have to ask other questions about what you want to know for and how's it going to be useful and so on, which academics have considered. But you know, I'd like to ask a question which I hope will pull together some of the issues that have been raised. It goes back to Howard's original question about, you know, is this overdriven by the Americans? It picks up this thing about definitions and also the questions about fair value. I've been trying to explain the last few weeks to my third year class the proposals on business combinations too. And you smile, and well you may, because only five of your 14 board dissented from issuing the exposure draft. And so you could say the exposure draft was only issued because it was a convergence project with the Americans. And the Americans knew what they wanted to do, and so you had to kind of put it out. But obviously a lot of people are very unhappy. And the particular things they seem to be very unhappy about are one, that it's kind of overdriven by this mania for getting the definitions right. You know, minority interests can't be a liability, so we have to rejig the whole thing to try and pretend they're the shareholders that we're reporting to. And fair value, you know, we must get fair value, so we can't go on just having the fair value of the assets that we've just acquired. We've got to try and guess what the fair value of the business that we've partially acquired would be if we'd acquired the whole thing, which, as you know, many commentators have just said is just pure fantasy accounting. So a number of issues there. How far does fair value go? Are definitions very helpful? And are the Americans driving the whole thing?
Well, the unfortunately, Richard, as you know, that when we come to deal with situations like cooperative banks in Germany, I can't say, well, the difference between equity and liability is a philosophical issue, and you know, one day we'll have an answer, because they've got to do it now. So we have to do something fairly urgently. Business combinations you raised, and you're quite right, there were five dissenters, and one more stops the standard. There were three in the United States, one more stops the standard. And you can imagine of those who assented, they may have assented because of an exposure draft. Well, put it out and see what happens. If I said there's not a lot of support for that exposure draft, that would be a gross exaggeration. Probably better to say there's no support for that exposure draft. Now, how did it get to where it did? It was a combination of factors. Fair value actually wasn't the one that was driving it. It might look like that, but what happened broadly was when we take over a company in Britain, most of the rest of the world, what we do is we revalue the assets that we take over to their values, their fair values. There's not much dispute about that. So if you have, let's say a company's got assets at cost of 100 sitting in its books, and when we take it over, the value is 200, we just change the value to 200, and that's what happens. In the United States, they don't do it that way. What they did was they would say, well, I've taken over 70% of the company. That has no effect whatever in the UK. You still value the whole thing at 200. What they would say was, that 70% belongs to me. I'll revalue 70% of the asset. So you get the asset, your 70% stake's worth 140, plus the cost of the other 30%, which is 30. So you get a number of 170, which doesn't mean very much, but that's the way they've always done it. So we persuaded them that was pretty ridiculous. And then they turned around to us and said, well, wait a minute, you're equally inconsistent, because you're saying the minority interest isn't being shown its stake of 60, but the minority interest also has a share of goodwill, which you say is an asset. So what is their share of goodwill? So that's where it came in from, that we should try and estimate their stake. Now, then, of course, do you simply extrapolate what you paid for your 70 and say the extra bit is the amount that goes on the minority interest, or do you have to say somewhere in there is a control premium, therefore it's less, and that's why there's a fair value of the company. Now, I wouldn't disagree with you when you said that it's very difficult to get that number, and that's come forward by many commentators. I may be surprised if that stayed in a final standard, frankly, but that's where it came from. It wasn't actually trying to pick the value. It came through a rather circuitous route, but I know it looks like that. The question of the minority interest was a debate that was 3 or 4 years ago, no, two years ago. Is it equity? Is it liability? The general view was it wasn't a liability. Well, we only have one other category, equity, unless we decide there's a mezzanine. Now, that's the next question.
Yeah, one in the front row.
Thank you, Sir David. My question is, have you met any problems while applying the international accounting standards to a particular country? Do you need to make any adjustments when applying these standards to different countries to suit their specific situations?
Well, what we try and do is the sort of thing that happens when a country says they would like to converge their standards with ours, we always say, well, we are actually after the best standard. Now, if you've got it, we should have it, like the New Zealand Consolidation Standard. We have to sort of move towards that eventually. What we ask the countries to do is, would you please set out what are the differences between your standards and the international standards? Then we want you to put them in three categories. One, which ones are due to your law and regulations? There is nothing we can do about that. That's your problem. Now, in Europe, there's been a lot of law and regulation change to make allowances so that they can converge with international standards. And it's part, if you like, the globalization of the capital markets, that various regulatory bodies are trying to have the same sort of rules so they don't penalize their own countries. So the rules are starting to move in line. The second one is we say, well, look at the standard and honestly say where you think probably the international answer is better, in which case you change. The third one is where you think you've got a better answer, we'll debate it. If it's just marginally better, given that we're going to have to ask 100 countries to change, we'll probably say it's not worth it. But if it's considerably better, then it's incumbent on us to say we've got to change. Sooner or later, we've got to change. Now, the other area where we have an issue is, are the economics different? And we simply haven't taken account of it in the standard, in which case we may have to write something into the standard to take account of that situation. Because if we didn't, you're going to get a rather false number. And we have all sorts of things in, well, China's a classic example. You have two fair values. You have one in Hong Kong and you have one in Shanghai, but they can't arbitrage the shares between themselves. So what's the value of the shares? And good question, we thought. I haven't thought of that one. It never occurred before. The Chinese government tells you what the fair value is. Now, is that the fair value? What do we do with this situation? We're going to have to start thinking about these sort of things. So we do look at the situation when these sort of facts are quite different from our own experience. But if it's just a law getting in the way and we see no difference in the economics, then, sorry, you have to change. And we had that with the European Union. When it came to sort of use our standards, said, now you must make sure that the international standards comply with the fourth directive. And we said, well, that's going to be difficult because we're actually making them comply with the Australian Corporation Act. And Europe said, well, that's ridiculous. And we said, well, that's funny. The Australians said it's ridiculous when we told them we're making them comply with the fourth directive. So we don't. We just write what we think the standard should be, the law, tax, everything else. We can't deal with that. That's up to the individual countries.
There's a couple more at the back that may, yeah, and I'll take those last three, okay? Back row first, and then you, yeah. Okay, you go ahead.
How would you respond to the criticism often made against ISB concerning its legitimacy? What I mean is that it's basically 14 people in a boardroom on their individual capacities as experts deciding on the world's global standards. And especially before the European adoption of IFRS, especially in most European countries, not most countries in the world, accounting standards used to be part of commercial law, commercial code, or general accounting plan, passed through parliament, and so on. So given that there's no comparable supervisory body, like, for example, the SEC in US, And the ISB, if I'm not wrong, was modeled, its current structure, after the American model. How you justify yourselves, for example, in relation to small countries that may think they don't have enough say, and they actually basically importers of accounting technology from 14 unelected persons?
Are you illegitimate?
Well, that's a question we were asked, mainly the trustees are asked. This was part of the constitutional discussions. Now, when the ISB was set up, there was a major dispute between Europe on one hand and the USA on the other. And the SEC believed that the American model was pretty good. Seven independent people. They thought, well, why don't we just translate that into international terms? Seven full-timers, regardless of nationality, set the standards. Europe preferred something much more representative. Part-time, nine from Europe, nine from North America, nine from the rest of the world, maybe a full-time chairman. And that was one model. Now, the SEC rejected it. But what happened was a compromise, because you got the trustees, 19, and Howard, in fact, was responsible for choosing some of these trustees, or all of the trustees, along with six other people, I think, regulators. But basically, it became six trustees from North America, six from Europe, seven from the rest of the world. So the balance was there. Seven was felt to be too small for the board. It went to 14. Two part-timers, another compromise, if you like. And then the question was, trustees had to choose these. Now, what did they go for? Well, you put yourself in their position. I mean, I wasn't in their position because they chose the board. But broadly speaking, this board had to become credible very quickly. You had the USA sitting across there. If this failed, US standards were going to run the world. Frankly, that's what was going to happen. So it chose, if you like, an experienced board. Now, that made an Anglo-Saxon bias almost right away, because that's where the standard setting was done. It was done mainly in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, US, UK. These were the standard setters that did most of the standards around the world, and most of the international standards were based in theirs. So you got a board which had five Americans, two of them sitting with British passports, a Canadian, chairman of the Canadian Standards Board, vice chairman of the American Standards Board came on board, me as chairman of the UK board, you had the director of the Australian Standards Setting Research Foundation. So it was all people who could take on FASB, if you like. Now that's going to change. In the next 18 months, three are leaving. Three Anglo-Saxons. Now the question is, who replaces them? The board has established itself now. We've got this convergence program with the states, but it's no use having, if you like, people on the board who can't persuade. You know, we keep saying to people, don't put a placeman on, or try and get a placeman on, because he'll vote against something. Well, that's fine, 13-1. He's got to be able to persuade another five to come with him if they want to stop something or create something, in which case he has to persuade another eight to form a majority. So he's got to have someone who understands the issues and can debate them. Now, clearly people take time to get speed up. But as these standards spread around the world, then more and more people have become knowledgeable, and then I can see the board changing completely in due course. We didn't set the 14. That was set for us, and that was assumed to be suitable for the international standards. But people will still argue, how many do you want on the board? 28? 143? You know, somewhere you've got to have a 14 is pretty hard to handle, I can tell you. It'd be easier with seven, but that couldn't be representative, and I understand that.
Next one, yeah. And then you, and then we'll wind up, I think.
Hi. David Bent from Forum for the Future. I spent the last year helping to write the Global Reporting Initiative Standard for Sustainability Reporting, so I don't really envy your task with trying to get those 14 people to agree. My question is about the interaction between financial reporting and non-financial reporting. Here in the UK, the Operating Financial Review was going along track and then was stopped in November, rather abruptly. What do you think is the best thing we can hope for here in the UK, and what do you think is the most likely thing we can hope for in terms of non-financial reporting?
Well, it's interesting, the government may be moving back a bit on that issue that on the OFR. But quite frankly, we have a discussion paper out at the moment on management commentary, which is an OFR, and it's been based on the work done in the UK, Germany, New Zealand and Canada, all of whom have put out something fairly recently on that issue. Personally, I think it's essential, because the more we move to show, if you like, the raw data in the accounts, the unsmooth pension numbers, you know, bang, here's your deficit, here how it's shifted, the more the questions are going to come, what are you going to do about it? And that in the UK is answered through the OFR. The point I made about the company saying we're going to put 5 million more in, etc. I think that's going to become probably the most important part of the reporting package. And I fully support it. Now, internationally, we have to decide, do we make it a standard? Do we make it best practice? Because a lot of people are concerned about it. And regulators, too, want to get involved in the sense there's corporate governance issues. We're not going to handle them. But we could perhaps give them the vehicle in which they can add bits to it. So I think it's going to become very important. I have no hesitation in saying it might be the most important part of the financial reports.
Yeah.
Well, I'm professional coming from visiting from Paris. And, we both have a problem for our clients of implementing IAS for... but also implementing new activities for banks. And we were very interested in the merger of accounting principles and business principles. And my question would be more on the IAS 14, which is very interesting but very difficult IAS to implement. Why? Because it forces companies to show a bit of their activity. Could you answer what is your position of this implementation of IAS 14?
Did you say 14 or
40? 40. Was it
40? 14. Sorry.
Which one's that?
The one describing the internal reportings and.
Oh, interim. Okay, I can never remember the numbers of these things. They,
sorry,
it's all right. No, I always.
It's not fashionable right now.
No. Interim, we're not doing anything in the meantime, basically, because we haven't got time. It's a question which ones we look at first. And when we took over, the regulators had criticised 17 of the standards we took over, including 39. And we really spent our time trying to fix that. Now, the question is, where does this come in the hierarchy when we're told by the SEC leasing and pensions is the most important issue? Everyone wants 39 changed. We've got insurance standards to do and so on. So it's in the list, but it's way, way back now. And that's one of the issues we're going to have to deal with. The others want, we want standards on, if you like, agriculture. That's another one that's a big issue part of the world. Well, that's another one we have to look at. Who's going to handle that for us? And agriculture has been one of the fascinating standards. When we're looking at that one, the huge argument between cost and value in that area too. I know when we looked at it, the Americans are very much for cost. Now, what is the cost of a newborn calf? You know, divide the mother by two, or do you make an estimate how many calves it's going to have? And I remember saying to this American, well, you know, he keeps going on about being brought up in a ranch in Oklahoma. So if you're on your deck out there in the ranch in Oklahoma and you suddenly see twice as many cows as you had the day before, do you not feel you're better off? And he said, no, I think the fence is down. And but these are the areas that are going to have to be brought back. But it takes a while. You can't do it all yet. So that's one on the list, I'm afraid, but way back.
I'm sure that you will agree that, listening to David, you can get to feel that setting international accounting standards is hugely important. It's actually quite fascinating, and it's also achievable. Now, I assure you that in my experience, the feeling passes quite soon after you stop listening. But that was really great. Thank you very much. I do have one last question, however, because one thing I didn't mention at the beginning is that David is a Newcastle United fan. Are you a candidate for the vacant manager position?
No, I think I'll leave that to Martin O'Neill, I think. Is the, yeah.
Well, we're delighted. I'm personally delighted that you, in fact, were reappointed recently for another term of another five years doing this. And maybe by the end of that, we will have a new IAS 39. But, Richard, I ought to ask you the final question. Would he pass the third year course that you're teaching?
It's a bit early in the year to give
a bit early to say, but thank you very much for coming. It was great.